The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I can start. I was going to talk about clinic and how that relates to public interest. That may be an obvious one, but there may be some particular clinics that would be useful for you to think about. And before I say anything else, let me give you my one pitch that I would urge you to do. And it's as much because of requirements in clinic as anything else, and that is really, really, really try to take evidence next year. The reason is that the DC practice rule requires you to have had and completed successfully evidence before you can be certified to practice in DC courts. Maryland has a different rule, you don't need that. And every year there are students who say want to do the domestic violence clinic or women in the law clinic, which require you to have DC be able to be admitted in D.C. as a student attorney, and you haven't done evidence yet, which means you can't do that clinic. Now, in the disability rights clinic, it's very helpful to have the D.C. certification. We can kind of get around it. We make you do it as a co-requisite in the first semester, but I know a lot of times students in the second year, they're trying to play who they're going to get, and they might not want to take certain people and take other people on. The fact is, I think there's a lot of choices about it with evidence. And should really try to do that. It's also just a great foundational course, including for public interest. A lot of what people do in public interest is litigation, some of which is certainly court-based, knowing what the rules of evidence are, kind of what counts as authoritative evidence from testimony and documents and what doesn't, is an important skill to have. So that's just a kind of, you know, overall commercial think about that, even if you don't think that it's directly related to public interest. In some sense, from the clinic standpoint, all the clinics really relate to public interest. Some of them, of course, have particular subject matters that may be appealing. So, for example, we have the disability clinic that does special ed work as part of what it does, the immigration justice clinic, which does immigration work on behalf of people with immigration issues, particularly workers, as well as our human rights clinic, which does asylum cases. I think that the basic thing I would say to you, if you're interested in doing public interest law, it's less important which particular clinic you do than that you do a clinic. And one of the reasons it's important is because unlike, say, large law firms, other places that don't expect you in the first couple of years to really be interacting with clients or, you know, being in court, and even to some degree government, a lot of public interest places really need you immediately to be able to hit the ground running. And certainly legal services, which is really a distinct part of, sometimes included in public interest. So your ability to present yourself as having had courses where you've actually represented clients, where you've had to, you know, counsel them, had to negotiate against the other side, go to court, is a really useful thing to have. And it's not only useful just as a way to present yourself, but it's just actually a good skill. And may give you a leg up against other people in the marketplace who are looking for jobs who don't have that experience. So from that standpoint, just even apart from whatever you learn, it's important in that way. Second, and probably maybe more importantly, we represent all the clients we represent are not clients who really otherwise could get private lawyers. So we either represent indigent defendants, for example, indigents in the civil system, or what I'd call underrepresented people or interests. So, for example, we have an intellectual property clinic. We don't represent the big record companies that are trying to, you know, make sure that they don't get lose out on their royalties of their artists, but we would represent people who are pursuing a public interest approach to IP issues. So that could be, you know, the small entrepreneur, the individual who wants to get his or her work out there in the marketplaces, but understand what limitations there might be on that, or somebody who wants to patent something, again, kind of mom and pop type of arrangement. It is very distinct in that clinic that the goal of it is to really assert the public interest perspective. As you may know, too, we have not a clinic, but we have PIDGIP, the public interest IP, or, you know, too many initials for me to kind of remember exactly, but basically the public interest focus of IP. So they are always doing activities, and they work closely with the clinic, and so that's even another thing they wanted to kind of get involved in. You know, our tax clinic would represent people, obviously, who are earners enough so that there can be an issue about their tax liability, but they're low-income taxpayers. They don't have millions of dollars at stake. We haven't yet represented someone like Donald Trump, for example. And so we're always trying to kind of get in there and say, like, we realize a very valuable resource to provide the student representation, and we're not going to make it available generally to people who otherwise could just go get a lawyer. Special ed is another example. It may be that the person technically might not be indigent, but it might be very difficult for them to get a lawyer to represent them. And it's a very complex system. You really need representation. So the ability to present yourself in the marketplace, the actual focus of the clinic, and of course the ability in clinic to not only represent actual clients and learn what that's about and decide whether you want to do that kind of work, which is great to think about abstractly, but you really don't know it until you're doing it, but also the ability to reflect on what you're doing in the process of doing the work you do. So the mantra we usually say is you plan an activity, you conduct the activity, and then you reflect on the activity. And we really do that in every clinic that we have here, which means that you come out of that experience, and this is true for any of the 10 clinics we have, with a much richer appreciation of not only what you're doing as a lawyer, but really what everybody else around you is doing. You know, you go to court and watch what lawyers are doing, even in a case you're not involved in. You know, you're like a sponge. You're soaking up all this stuff. You're seeing what's going on. You can start beginning to think about, is this the kind of lawyer I want to be? You know, gee, I really thought that person seemed really prepared and sharp, and here's this other person who really didn't seem to be. And, you know, you start developing your own sense of identity, which, you know, the Carnegie Report, one of the big recent reports about legal education, talks about as one of the key parts of what law school should be about, that, to be honest, isn't always as emphasized as it ought to be. So that's, I think, a really important part of what I would call the public interest curriculum is to do one of the clinics. It is the last couple of years, including this year, we've had many more people who wanted to do clinic than we've had slots. I think, Nick, you were one of the applicants, and we took no second-year students, rising second-year students, and we weren't able to serve all the third-year students. So I can't sit here today and say to you, absolutely, if you want to do a clinic, you will get a chance to do it. But you got a good shot to do it, and certainly I would encourage you to explore any one of the clinics that you might be interested in. So I think that's pretty much what I want to say about. Oh, the last thing I just would say, because I don't think any of us is necessarily going to talk about this, but a really great thing to do if you're interested in public interest is externships. And it's a very good thing to do summer after your first year or during your second year. Because the one thing externships do, it's not the same as the clinic, you don't have the same level of responsibility, but you are in the setting itself where they're doing the kind of work. Many of us have taught externship seminars. If you're interested in women's rights and you're working at the National Women's Law Center, what a great way to see, not just I wonder what kind of cases they handle, but seeing how they actually do it, seeing whether that kind of workplace is the kind of workplace you want to do, you want to be involved in. And so it's a very good progression to think about it as externship as something often you do second year, get really exposed, really see what's going on. Third year, do a clinic where you get more of your own actual responsibility.
Okay. I'll just add a few things and won't hopefully repeat anything Bob has said. I will second what he said about clinics and externships as a good place to explore a public interest that you all might have. I will also definitely second evidence. I think evidence is such a good course, both because it's important for practice, it's important for participation in many clinics. I think it actually helps you understand other courses better, because so much of what you're reading in cases in other classes is built on evidence, what came in, what didn't come in. I took a quick look at the registration for evidence, and I did notice midweek it wasn't filling up very fast with 3Ls, so that may be that there will still be room for 2Ls to sign up even in the fall, so I put in a plug for that. We all were just talking here about the difficulty of defining a public interest curriculum. I mean, some things are obvious: civil rights, criminal defense, disability rights. But there really isn't any such thing. I mean, you all have identified particular areas of interest that you have, and I would label those public interest. I would also say virtually any course in the catalog that I looked at could be approached from a public interest perspective. So I think it's hard to give general advice. I do think of that, it's, I sort of think of public interest law as sort of having two pieces. One is sort of representing poor people. And I think the other, I think Bob put it well, sort of representing underrepresented interests. And obviously there's overlap there, you know. Underrepresented interests often include poor people, but some of those issues are very different than legal services work. You know, you might be doing, you know, pro-choice work for NARAL or something like that. That clearly has a impact on poor people, but it's a more general sort of civil rights focus. And for those of you that mentioned having Hill backgrounds or things like that, maybe you're more interested in sort of legislative advocacy, which is another slice of it. So I think apart from your particular subject matter interest, there's a couple things I would say that you might generally think about. I think it's good to have a legal background in different types of things. I do litigation. That's really what I know. If I were going to law school now, I would definitely take a course on legislation or some sort of legislative advocacy. I think it's really important, and I think it's a, you guys know better than we do, jobs are very tough these days, and I would say broadening your skill set, especially now, is especially important. I don't know if that's being offered in the fall. I did not take a look at whether it is, but it's usually offered, I believe, once a year.
It's on my list, too. See, it is. Legislative process. So I have a fall schedule.
It's really, I think that's really, really important to take a course like that. I mean, you have to take it this fall, but take it sometime, even if you think, all I want to do is litigate, because we have a lot of litigation stuff in this law school. And as Bob mentioned, those are all predicates to public interest practice, too. You can take pretrial advocacy, you can take trial advocacy, you can take evidentiary foundations. They now have 5 or 6 specialty courses under the trial ad rubric. But sort of don't, I think, forget that other skill set, I think. And one of you mentioned wanting to just learn how to be a better advocate for whatever interest you want to represent. And I think that broad course range is important. I would say also make sure you take a small seminar or two next year if you can in an area that you are interested in. For example, you mentioned disability rights. That would be Bob. Civil rights education. That would be, I'm calling people by their first names, that's Professor Dinnerstein and Professor Epperson. Okay. Find those professors that are active and teach in the areas that you're interested in, and then seminars are a good way to build an expertise, write a paper, form those connections. So I think it's good not to just be talking about the big courses. Sometimes the big course is a prerequisite for the seminar, but a lot of times it's not.
And just on that point, really quickly, in terms of how people get jobs, obviously there's a lot of kinds of ways that you can do it, and the first thing always to say is, just how well you perform and how you can present yourself, and that's good to do generally. But when you write a paper in a seminar and that professor gets to know your work, and then you get asked to do recommendations, it's a lot easier to be able to give a good recommendation to someone who's written a really thorough, well-written, well-researched paper. And one of the things about a lot of us, and particularly I'd say this is true in the clinic, but not only in the clinic, is, you know, because we're out doing work in the city around, we have connections with people. So, you know, it's not uncommon to get a call from a public defender or from somebody in a legal aid office saying, well, we've got, you know, so-and-so is applied to us, and we see that, you know, listed you as a reference. What do you think of that person? Or maybe even have a letter go with them. And you'd say, you know, she's terrific. She did this, I can tell you. And it's not like, I check my records and I see that Mary got an A- in my class, so, you know, she did very well. Well, that's great. That's not going to really help you so much. So I think this point about being, and I always think students could do this much more, be strategic about, you know, if you know what your interests are or think you know what they are, you know, make friends with faculty in that area, try to see what those faculty teach, take those courses, as one, you know, not the only thing to do, but, you know, it's to be honest, it's kind of a campaign, and so you might as well think about it in those very strategic types of ways, because it only can help you. You know, every once in a while, we'll hear anecdotally, someone will say, wow, I was interviewing so-and-so, and I told them I was working. And I said, oh, my God, you're working, you know. And, of course, we hate hearing that. But the main thing is not that they're saying about us, but that they then say, okay, well, I know who that person is. I know the work that person's doing. If that person is vouching for you, that really says a lot. And you know, it's not like 100 people are going to get that. But if you're in one of those categories, that might help. Sorry.
So that's great. And, you know, so find a mentor or two, if you can, in the law school. I think that everybody should be able to do that. I think that's just important. The seminars can help. I'm sure the first year electives, at least they're a little bit smaller. They've kind of given you folks, I think, a little bit of taste of that. You've probably taken courses that you love. So do that. Just a couple more things. Talking about specializing, not specializing. You can tell I'm a fan of not specializing, but I think it is important to have kind of a track where you can sort of say, I really know a lot about this thing. That's my own personal view on it. So, you know, if you're interested, a couple of people mentioned immigrant rights, let's say international human rights, something like that. I think that's great. Whatever a specialty would entail, and those aren't my fields, I can't tell you what that would be, but let's say 3 or 4 courses where you're kind of focusing on that. But don't single track yourself, because I have, I can think of numerous students in recent years very interested in criminal defense, which is great. I love it. But then if they want to look at something that isn't criminal defense, then the employers ask, well, what else have you done? And it's all criminal defense. That doesn't mean you can't do a lot of that, but you also might expand to civil legal services type topics, civil rights. It can still be very public interesting, but don't try not to track yourself so much. Also, perhaps radical advice. I think bar courses are okay. I would not load up on them. I think, you know, everybody, you can figure out what the bar courses are. Maybe look at all of them. Lots of them are required courses anyway. Take a couple. Don't take 6 or 7, because if you do that, you're not going to have anything left in the curriculum to do anything else. That's my view. I personally have my favorites. Tax would be one of them. I love tax, but, you might pick BA.
You just lost the audience.
Whatever. I know. Whatever. But that's public interest, too. And immigration law, just on the sort of interesting classes, that's taught as a large course, and they're also smaller courses. There's one specifically on workers' rights that our colleague Jish Rato teaches. But I think immigration law now is starting to cut across all of these fields. Certainly criminal law, certainly, you know, some aspects of education law, some aspects of mental health law. You really can't go anywhere given the developing demographics of this country without having to think of that very seriously. So that's a course I think that's becoming increasingly popular. It's typically offered, I think, still once each semester. That's one I would sort of put on the, even if you haven't thought of it on your radar screening, one I would take. I would sort of put it in that, not quite up there with evidence, but in that category. So that's all that I'll say on that.
Yeah. Actually, it's kind of a great segue. I tend to look at academic advising more from the reverse perspective of, you kind of know where you want to be. I work with you a lot more in terms of your actual jobs, what you're out there doing. And so how does that actually back up to the very beginning where you are now? How did you start with the classes that you were interested in that got you the internships that you wanted, that met you, you know, where you got the networking and you met the people and that sort of thing? So I would say just keep in mind that scheduling, for one thing, and academic counseling, don't look at it in a vacuum. There are lots of different folks around the building that can help you think academically as much as think career-wise. They're not two separate things. They're very much interrelated. So, you know, think about when you get that first internship, if that's in an area of law you're really interested in, you need to talk to the folks who were there, the lawyers who were there. What classes did they take? What are they looking for when they hire someone? Think about it from their point of view when they are looking at candidates. What is going to make you marketable to them? Additionally, you know, the networking. We're talking about all these experiential learning opportunities, doing the clinics, doing externships. A lot of people end up getting jobs because of the folks that they know through those. So there are benefits outside of just what you're learning in the classroom for those. So those are really important. It's good to have, you know, a well-rounded resume from that perspective. I think the advice of doing an externship during your 2L year followed up by clinic the 3L year is absolutely the way to go and the most successful. I just think public interest law, when people come in and say, I want to do public interest law, so help me find the job. It's the same thing with help me find what classes to take. People are afraid to close doors. You're afraid to close out certain things, and classes are just as easily, you're afraid to close that out as much as you are, I think I want to do civil rights, but I also want to do, you know, immigration law. Well, first of all, there's a lot of overlap. People don't want to close things out, so they tend to kind of do this broad curriculum, and then they end up not being well suited to anything in one thing in particular. You are going to at some point start to close doors, but honestly it opens up other doors for you. So don't be afraid of, this is a class I really wanted to take, I just don't know how I'm going to fit it in on top of everything else. That is going to happen. I think one thing that helps, one thing that I did as a student, one thing I work with other students on is don't be afraid. You have 4 semesters left plus potentially 2 summers to take classes. It's okay to actually go ahead and kind of plan out roughly what you think you might want to take, looking at especially your third year, if there are classes that are more advanced, what are the prerequisites that you need to get out of the way during your 2L year, and look at those, how do you fit those in addition to, you know, if you're doing an externship one semester, that course load maybe needs, you need to back it down in your doctrinal classes. So really look at it from a much bigger perspective of just these are the 4 or 5 classes I know I want to take that semester. Really try to plan out your remaining academic career. And then how do you fit the experiential learning, how do you fit the internships, everything else into it. I think that's all I want to say now is just really keep a broad sense of, you know, who can help you think about academic planning beyond just looking in the course catalog. And even outside of law school, especially working with employers and that sort of thing, getting their point of view. It's always very helpful.
So I will add just a few more points because I think we've pretty much pretty well covered everything. But I see the planning as looking at a few big areas. There's a question about general coursework to take that may be helpful and useful in public interest work and experience. There's a question of the experiential learning and the practical experience that you get. And then there's that piece of what do I need to do to get the job that I want. For the general coursework, I agree with Vinny that you don't want to take every bar course, mm-hmm. but I do think, as you mentioned, that there are some I flipped through the fall semester course offerings to see, out of those, what I thought would be helpful courses to give a general overview. And these may not hold water for all public interest jobs, but I do think that they're helpful to get some foundational experience and would be helpful for upper-level seminars and other courses. One, everybody already said, was evidence. I think everybody needs to take it early because it will help you not only in clinic but even in, you know, some other upper level courses. And I also raise these because if you're looking for courses even for the fall and you want to know what you can get into, you may not be able to get into all the seminars that look interesting to you, but these are the courses, as Professor Miller was saying, that still have plenty of seats available. So evidence is one of them. I also would say legislative process, and I'd actually say admin law, administrative mm-hmm. law as well.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion.
These are kind of foundational courses. You're not required to take them, but there are aspects of these courses that will be helpful to you in much of the public interest work someone would be drawn to. So admin law, legislative process, or some kind of class on legislation. It happens to be called legislative process in the fall. And these are courses that are not seminars. Federal courts is another one that I'm actually a fan of in terms mm-hmm. of a foundational course. If you are interested at all in pursuing any kind of a federal judicial clerkship, when I clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, my judge required that all of his clerks would take federal courts. So that's true of some judges, they will require it. But even if they do not, I think Brenna and Nick may have heard me say this a bunch in con law. I'll raise something and say, and we can't really discuss it in detail, yeah. but if you take Professor Vladeck or Professor Frost's federal courts course next year, you know, you can get all into to the deeper complexities of this issue. I think there are a lot of interesting points about how our courts work, how federal courts work, that are discussed in the Fed courts class. I would see that as another great foundational course. And other than admin law, legislative process, Fed courts, and evidence, the other one that sort of jumped out at me for general coursework in the fall of 2011 was Advanced Civ Pro. So for those of you who are interested in litigating, it basically gives you, Brenna, has this look like you lost me there. it's not for everyone, but for those who may be interested in more complex litigation, this is the course that would give you that information. And for some, that might be something that's more in the substantive area of interest. So maybe you're interested in public interest law, but not in that kind of litigation. If you are, that would be the course for that. And then in terms of the practical experience, I'm a huge advocate for the externship program. Every time a student comes to my office to talk about academic planning and career planning, I tell them to do an externship, and I don't even know what the limit is, but I was told, is it something like how much credit does a student get for? Is it two externships? You can only do one externship?
You can do up to 12 outside of classroom credits at an externship. At least the first externship is going to be 6 credits, 3 in the field component, 3 in the classroom. Okay. The 3 classroom, though, are classroom credits, so it's technically that externship, that the 3 hours for that first externship will be outside of the classroom.
Which is also a moment to say, because this rumor comes up every year, and it's not true. All the clinic grades are considered academic grades and classroom grades. So sometimes students say, gee, can I take a clinic because I've already done a journal, I've done an externship, I want to do moot court. Clinic stuff is all considered classroom. As Jared correctly said, in the externship, the seminar portion is classroom, but the fieldwork is not. So you, generally, you can't do more than three. Well, you can't do more than three credits of fieldwork in an externship. So I think it's not uncommon that people do two externships. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can do more than two, and frankly, I'm not sure you ought to, because at some point, part of what we're all talking about is the balance of the things you want to do, mm-hmm. and so that would be. But at least two.
Yeah, so I'm a fan of that. I think that goes into that area of practical experience that could include the clinical experience that could in some ways include more practical skills that you would get in a course like TriLab, but that are a great way to take advantage of what WCL has to offer being in the nation's capital. And so for those of you who are interested in public interest law, in all of these areas, there are tremendous opportunities here in Washington. And the benefit of an externship is that you get that experience during the term time, when there are numerous organizations throughout this city that are really the best in what they do. You know, if you're interested in gender discrimination issues and you want to work with the National Women's Law Center, these are lawyers who are doing amazing work, and they have hundreds of applicants every summer. But the benefit of being a student here is that you can get credit to work with those people during the school year. And when I used to direct education litigation policy at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and here in our office, you know, I'd have swarms of applicants for the summer, and then students would go back to their institutions, and I still needed help. And in fact, I had more work that needed to be done throughout that academic year. There were far fewer students fighting for that substantive experience, and I would argue that you get as good, if not better, substantive experience during a term time internship, because there are fewer students working there, and yet those professors and I'm sorry, those advocates and the litigators and those people working on policy issues have the same workload. And so you can get, I think, very good substantive experience mm-hmm. and create really meaningful and lasting relationships that take you out of law school and help to help you to make a much easier transition into the job market, not only because you've had the experience, but because now those lawyers all know you. And they can say, I had an argument in the Fifth Circuit, and I had to write this brief on X, Y, and Z, and Brenna was in my office helping me to draft all of this stuff, and can speak very clearly and substantively about that work. So I think it's actually a very important part of your overall academic experience. The last thing I would say is just that point about ultimately how you get those jobs. And so thinking strategically about those things that will take you one step closer. So I think one step is the externship, because not only for the substance, but the connections that you create. One piece is the seminars that you would take in more of a sort of specialized area, because you also, not only do you write the paper, but you create those relationships with professors who, if they're teaching the course, probably know a fair amount about that subject matter and may have those connections professionally in that area that can then help you. So I think those are things to think about when you're trying to strategize about what you're doing now that takes you out of WCL and into the workforce.
I want to mention a couple of other things that are sort of random, but I think can be helpful. When I teach my disability seminar, students have to write a long research paper. And I always say to them that as you're looking for topics, and I give them a whole list of topics that people have written about, and they it's up to them as to what to choose. But one thing I always say to them is, if you know people in public interest, and you've worked there, or even if you don't know them, and you call them up and say, I'm in this course on disability law, and you call the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, and you say, are there any issues that your office is facing that would be really interesting, and you'd really love to have the benefit of the research, and I'm going to do it for a paper, but I'm happy to share that with you. And my experience is that people love getting those calls. They are happy to say, well, right now, the big issue is Olmstead implementation. That's the issue. I said, great, that sounds, can you tell me more about it? If you get that, you're doing two things. You're satisfying the upper-level writing requirement, which you need to do, but you're also making this connection. And, imagine you make that call, you write a great paper, the person sees the paper, and says, oh, somebody's really on the ball here, and they're a step ahead of somebody else. I mean, I think that absolutely can be something that can be, again, a kind of win-win type of situation. since we broadened a little bit in terms of just general, let me give you my little two cents about course selection thing. And like one, I think it's a really good idea to take the teacher, that is, to think about people who you have heard are good people, you know, good professors, good teachers, particularly if you, and I'd say from a first-year perspective, if you had people that you really liked their style, they worked with you, say, well, okay, I'm going to, you know, first of all, I'm going to try to follow that person in other courses. Secondly, maybe I can find other people who seem to have a style similar to that or an approach similar to that, because that's one that for me. Because you might learn a lot in a course that you don't think immediately you're actually that interested in, but you know the professor is somebody who makes that issue interesting for you or that those issues interesting for you. And I think we sometimes, it's hard to talk about that because although I'd love to give you, well, here's the list of really good teachers and here's the list of not so good, we don't really talk about it in those terms, which is why I say it's really something from student to student. Yeah, hey, what are you hearing? Who's the people that you know, you shouldn't miss? And I will say that in law school, I didn't do that as much as I would have liked. And one of the courses that I regret not having taken, believe it or not, is Admiralty. Not that I have any interest in Admiralty, although if I were going to New Orleans, it would be an important course. But it was taught by Charles Black, who was a famous civil rights lawyer. Yep. Mm-hmm. And basically, whether he was teaching Admiralty or something else, mm-hmm. it was Charles Black. And I would say, you know, I should have taken him because of him. And so I would not downplay that as one of the factors to weigh. Second thing is, and I think Jared's right, I think you have to look at this as 4 semesters at least, not even including summer, and think about what you want to do when. You don't want to take 2 big 4-credit semi-required bar type courses maybe the same semester, because that's going to be a lot of intensive work. So maybe what you do is say, look, I've heard everything. I think I want 4 of those courses over the course of 2 years. So maybe you try to do 1 a semester. So the semester you're taking BA and, you know, hoping it's going to be okay, maybe that's not the same semester to take tax. Maybe you take that in the spring. Maybe you take evidence first, as we keep saying, and do the others later. And then, you know, you might say, all right, upper level writing. I have to write a seminar paper unless I'm writing a note or a comment. I could wait till the 3rd year to do that. A lot of students do. But if I do it the 2nd year, I might be able to make some of these connections that we've been talking about. It might be more helpful to me to have that earlier rather than later by the time at which, when I need the recommendation, the professor doesn't really know me that well. It also gets out of the way something which is otherwise a requirement. So that can be, you know, useful to do that. Journals, you know, if you're interested in writing on to a journal, why not write about something that is a public interest topic? Again, it may or may not be connected to a seminar, but it can show somebody that you have an interest in those things. You know, obviously within specific areas, there's particular courses that make a lot of sense. So, you know, in disability, there's a special education course, there's any civil rights course, you know, employment discrimination would be helpful, and civil rights would be helpful, obviously law of disability would be. In international and public interest, I guess actually the young woman who left, you know, there are from time to time, Rick Wilson teaches a course on international public interest law. I mean, literally write about that topic. And obviously, some of those are not courses offered all the time, so you want to just be looking every semester. And it might be that if you, you know, what I might do, by the way, in addition to just looking at what's on the schedule for the spring, for the fall for next year, I might go back, and you can look on the web and just see, well, let me just look back over a couple of years. And maybe you find in there, wow, here's a course that I don't see being offered in the fall, but it looks like it was offered, you know, 2 years ago in the fall. It's Professor Wilson. Call him up. Stop by his office and say, well, I noticed you taught, you know, public interest law, international public interest. Are you thinking about doing that again? And you might learn, yeah, actually, now that you mentioned, I'm going to be teaching it next fall. Well, you didn't teach it last year. Well, that's because I was on sabbatical last year, so, you know, wasn't doing that. So, you know, and frankly, not that this is your purpose, but, you know, if several people are saying that to someone, oh, I really, you know, wish we were offering this, that can be some, actually have an effect on people's, you know, marginal decision about, like, what last course to teach, for example, other than the other courses you do. So, you know, I will say, finally, this school in particular, there's much, much more that here that you could possibly take. And the issue is not to be defeated by that, not to go, away, oh, I couldn't, I didn't take this. You will find your way, and the fact of that, those series of choices, is actually a good thing, not a bad thing, because there's not one path. There's so many different. I mean, even BA that you were talking about. You know, I was saying this before we started. I work with a lot of nonprofits on their boards and all that, and one of the things that public interest lawyers need to know about, especially if like they're going to start a public interest organization, which is another thing you could do. How do we organize ourselves? Do we know anything about articles of incorporation? Do we know anything about our bylaws? What about getting our nonprofit status so we can get contributions? Those are things. Now, you can learn those things without having taken a course, but it can be helpful to not only whether you're doing it directly to know what you need to know. And so that's just part of that. And I also think that, again, I would agree with those who say be careful about over-specialization, because some things you may think right now you absolutely know you want to work in some area, and then you take some that you didn't think you were interested in, all of a sudden it turns you on, and you're interested, and you want to somewhat hedge your bets.
Well, I've known Bob for a long time, but I bet you don't know that my highest grade in law school was in BA. In fact, I had no interest in BA, and I had the highest grade in the BA class, and I never had the highest grade in any other class. So you just never know what'll kind of grab your brain unexpectedly. So, questions for us? We probably overwhelmed you with that.
Well, I know a lot of you mentioned different areas that you were interested in. One thing I did want to mention is I think in terms of the job prospects, government has been hot here the last couple of years, somewhat hotter because some of the other areas, some of the other employers aren't as hot, so maybe that's partially. But obviously you're in D.C. as well, so you have a lot of exposure to government. Almost all of these areas of law could fit into a government position somewhere in some agency. One thing I would stress a little bit, we talk a lot about the experiential things, but when we're talking about government, they do want to see those classes that we listed, evidence, admin law, the legislation class, depending on what you're doing, and they want to see that you did well. So I don't want us to overshadow the importance of doing well in those classes, because it's a weed out factor for them when they get a lot of applications from a lot of folks who are very interested. One of the ways that they can, to make their determination or looking at your resume and your transcript and seeing how you did in these what they believe to be core classes to the type of work that they do. So I can't stress enough the importance of doing well in those classes that were listed.
And I do think, actually, it's great to mention government really as some kinds of government practice are really public interest practice. Both Benny and I worked in the Civil Rights Division. I worked in a section that did large institutional litigation against institutions for people with disabilities, and being in the voting rights section. And in those sections, it's really like being a public interest lawyer with resources, because the government, I spent a lot of time in Alabama, actually, doing mental health litigation there, and,
was related to Bryce.
To Wyatt, Bryce Hartlow, yeah. And Searcy, and all the regional centers. And, I spent a summer down there. We took about 100 depositions. Most public interest organizations wouldn't be able to support that. The government comes in and, kind of do that. And so now things changed a little bit on January 20th, 1981, but when Ronald Reagan came in, different view of civil rights. But the point is that I've really felt that I was a public interest lawyer, and we had lots of relationships with legal services offices and public interest organizations as well.
I do a lot of work with government lawyers, and I would actually recommend, when I talk about externships to students, I actually specifically mention government work. I think if you're interested in public interest work, and I missed the descriptions, but I think almost everything fits into some kind of government agency, and that's a very useful experience to have, even if your initial reaction is that you wouldn't work for the government, because there are all of these different departments, these different sections, these different agencies that do really interesting public interest work.
Yeah, every year I see students come in, and never would I think I'm going to do government work and transition by the time that they're leaving. Mm-hmm. That government is definitely an option to them.
Judicial internships also, we talked about externships, if you're doing them for credit. Professor Epperson mentioned clerking, and I clerked as well, and those are really interesting in their own right to learn how a judge thinks, but they could sometimes, and especially here, lead to employment either with that judge or another judge on the same court, particularly lots of opportunities at D.C. Superior Court and Maryland Circuit Courts, Virginia Circuit Courts, which are all very well-regarded trial courts, as well as appellate court opportunities or federal district court opportunities, so don't forget those. They're great, and you get if you pick the right judge, you get a really great mentor for life.
Mm-hmm. So what haven't we told you that you wanted to
know? How do you select applicants for a clinic? Is it grades, past experience?
No. we do I'm going to say, more or less a lottery. In some clinics, it's pure lottery. They literally do, you know, a random number generator to come up with numbers, and that's who gets in. And then if you don't get in, you know, to that, we look at your, you know, second and third and whoever choice. My now 26-year-old son, 1 year, the way people got into clinic was we had the names, you know, numbers in a hat, and he just kind of pulled them out when, as he was on, you know, like not even a year old. And so I always look at that group and say, you don't know it, but your name
you
was
gummed
by my baby. Some of the clinics do look for, or essentially conduct a lottery, but we'll look for certain plus factors and might include that. So diversity could be plus factor, language capacity might be. So for example, in the immigrant justice clinic where we represent a lot of Spanish-speaking clients, somebody who is fluent in Spanish, that might be helpful. You know, in my clinic, this hasn't arisen, but if we had somebody who had a disability, was, you know, an evident disability, that might be a reason if they didn't get in to do that. But for the most part, we do it by lottery. That's got advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that it is neutral in the sense that we're not trying to say, oh, this person would benefit more than that person, which are very hard judgments to make because, frankly, my view is everybody ought to do the clinic. The disadvantage is, and it's absolutely a disadvantage, is, you know, we get students all the time who tell us, I came here because of the clinic, sometimes even because of this particular clinic. And, you know, you might be, don't get in, and then someone else who says, gee, number two in U.S. News, I don't know if I'm really interested, but I'll try it. And then they get it, right? And you might say, well, that's not really fair. But there's no really great way to do it. One way or the other, you've got some kind of issue. This year, we, as I said, there's a lot of folks who, at least the first run-through, are not being offered a slot. Some may drop, so we may have an opportunity to serve others. But, you know, there are resource questions. I mean, the only reason the clinic can work as well as it does is we have to have a relatively low faculty-student ratio so that we can supervise you adequately so you can go do the good work that you do. So it's not just like a question of, let's add another section of, you know, evidence law because we have so many people wanting to do evidence. It doesn't quite work that way. But we're always thinking about ways that we can, you know, persuade the administration that we need more resources and to think about this because we do think it's an important program to have. And you know, while there are things that can get you close to it, you know, I just think there's really no substitute for being able to do that. So, but it isn't, it is not grade related at all. Indeed, I'd say grades sometimes are good predictors of clinic success and sometimes not, in either direction. There are students who have more difficulty with some of the standard courses and they shine in clinic because they're really good at a lot of the organizational, interpersonal, other kind of things. They write well. They maybe don't test as well, but that's not an issue so much in clinic. And then conversely, there are people who are great in those other classes and, you know, when they get with clients, it's like they're on Mars. And so now I think we have a lot to help those students get better. Again, it doesn't matter what you come in with, we try to work with you. But so we don't, that is one thing we absolutely don't look at. Other questions?
We were that thorough.
Apparently, you know, we
were pretty thorough.
We just killed them with info. But, you know, I guess I'll say one other thing about public interest, and Jared, I'm sure, runs into this all the time. I remember when I was a second-year law student working in New York over the summer, and we were went to some event that a well-known public interest lawyer was speaking at, John Shattuck, who later went on to lots of other things too. And he essentially said, you know, a lot of like summer associates he was talking to, says, you know, look, hard to get a job in public interest. Don't, you know, I mean, I don't want to discourage you, but it's just about impossible. So probably you ought to do is, you know, go work in private practice and then maybe eventually you'll get it. And, you know, I remember thinking, we went to it. Why did we go to this program? Why didn't we be told this? Seemed pretty defeating. Well, I think it's a different way of looking for a job, but it need not be impossible to do. And I think a lot of what we're saying is, what can you do to kind of improve your chances? I mean, right now you're in a market where any time a job opens up, there's hundreds of folks in there. What's going to get yours up to the top of the pile rather than buried in the pile? Sometimes it's who you've worked with. Sometimes it's where you went to school or how well you did in that school. Sometimes it's the courses that you did. All those things can play a role. But I think that if you are reasonably aggressive in the sense of spending time following up on things, you know, having an up-to-date resume so that if you hear about a job, you can get the thing out immediately and not have to wait a week to do it. All those are really helpful types of things. If you have some geographical flexibility, right? So, I mean, a lot of people, it's a wonderful place, D.C. A lot of people want to come here to school, want to stay here, and that's great. And it's a great city for public interest law, absolutely. But if that's the only place you're looking, you know, that's a more difficult. It's a national employer, too. So you want to be a public defender, you want to work in, I work at Public Defender Service in Washington, great place to work, but everybody in the country wants to work there. So you're not just even competing with local folks. On the other hand, you know, if you're willing and can in your circumstances, you know, work for California Rural Legal Assistance, you may get a terrific job that may not be in the place you think you want to wind up living for the rest of your life, but, you know, right out of law school, depending on your personal circumstances, a couple of years might be a terrific experience. So it's not, you know, in fact, what's happened is because the market has changed. The days that there was a whole group of people who could pretty much just, you know, wait till on-campus interviewing in the fall, you know, have a good interview with the firm, get a call back, get the job offer, you're set. That's not happening. So in a sense, the sort of the whole process is coming down more to what people who wanted to do public interest or small firms always had to do, which was to kind of recognize that people don't always know in September of your third year what jobs they're going to have as of July of the following year. So you have to be in touch with them. They'll say, well, we'll be in touch with you, but that's not going to be enough. So, you know, every once in a while, just checking in to see if, you know, anything's there. And you have to be able to tolerate a certain amount of uncertainty for that. If you can do that, absolutely can find a job in the area you want. And also remember that there's always that big focus on that first job. You know, most lawyers have 5 or 6 jobs over the course of their career. And so it's one thing I always say to people is, it may not be your dream job, but is it giving you something, either skills or connections, that will help you get closer to what you think you really want that job to be? And so, again, I do like the idea of working backwards. That's where you want to get to 2-3 years from now. How do you get to that point through the courses and other activities you might engage in?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for coming. Feel free to come by.
Most of us don't bite.
I think using faculty are really key. They will give you good advice on classes. Go talk to someone. Just ask them what they think you should take. Mm-hmm. Don't go it alone.
That's true. We'll tell you.
We will.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Yes. Let's see. This goes to 390.